other planets, same as we have, and their HQ is still intact. So unless they surrender, the war isn't over. We didn't have Nova bombs at that time. We couldn't crack Klenda Thu open. If they absorbed the punishment and didn't surrender, the war was still on. If they can surrender. Their soldiers can't. Their workers can't fight. And you can waste a lot of time and ammo shooting up workers who wouldn't say boo. And their soldier caste can't surrender. But don't make the mistake of thinking that the bugs are just stupid insects because they look the way they do and don't know how to surrender. Their warriors are smart, skilled, and aggressive. Smarter than you are, by the only universal rule, if the bug shoots first. You can burn off one leg, two legs, three legs, and he just keeps on coming. Burn off four on one side and he topples over, but keeps on shooting. You have to spot the nerve case and get it. Whereupon he will trot right on past you, shooting at nothing until he crashes into a wall or something. The drop was a shambles from the start. 50 ships were an hour piece of it, and they were supposed to come out of Cherenkov Drive and into Reaction Drive so perfectly coordinated that they could hit the orbit and drop us, in formation and where we were supposed to hit, without even making one planet's circuit to dress up their formation. I suppose this is difficult. Shucks, I know it is. But when it slips, it leaves the MI holding the sack. We were lucky at that, because the Valley Forge and every Navy file in her bought it before we ever hit the ground. In that tight, fast formation, 4 miles per second, orbital speed is not a stroll, she collided with the Ypres, and both ships were destroyed. We were lucky to get out of her tubes, those of us who did get out, for she was still firing capsules as she was rammed. But I wasn't aware of it. I was inside my cocoon, headed for the ground. I suppose our company commander knew that the ship had been lost, and half his wildcats with it, since he was out first and would know when he suddenly lost touch, over the command circuit, with the ship's captain. But there was no way to ask him, because he wasn't retrieved. All I ever had was a gradually dawning realization that things were in a mess. The next 18 hours were nightmare. I shan't tell much about it, because I don't remember much. Just snatches. Stop-motion scenes of horror. I've never liked spiders, poisonous or otherwise. A common house spider in my bed can give me the creeps. Tarantulas are simply unthinkable. And I can't eat lobster, crab, or anything of that sort. When I got my first sight of a bug, my mind jumped right out of my skull and started to yammer. It was seconds later that I realized that I had killed it and could stop shooting. I suppose it was a worker. I doubt if I was in any shape to tackle a warrior and win. But at that, I was in better shape than was the K-9 Corps. They were to be dropped, if the drop had gone perfectly, on the periphery of our entire target, and the Neo-Dogs were supposed to range outward and provide tactical intelligence to interdiction squads, whose business it was to secure the periphery. Those Calebs weren't armed, of course, other than their teeth. A Neo-Dog is supposed to hear, see, and smell and tell his partner what he finds by radio. All he carries is a radio and a destruction bomb with which he, or his partner, can blow the dog up in case of bad wounds or capture. Those dogs didn't wait to be captured. Apparently, most of them suicided as soon as they made contact. They felt the way I do about the bugs, only worse. They have Neo-Dogs now that are indoctrinated from puppyhood to observe and evade without blowing their tops at the mere sight or smell of a bug. But these weren't. That wasn't all that went wrong. Just name it. It was fouled up. I didn't know what was going on, of course. I just stuck close behind Dutch, trying to shoot or flame anything that moved, dropping a grenade down a hole wherever I saw one. Presently, I got so that I could kill a bug without wasting ammo or juice, although I did not learn to distinguish between those that were harmless and those that were not. Only about 1 in 50 is a warrior, but he makes up for the other 49. Their personal weapons aren't as heavy as ours, but they are lethal just the same. They've got a beam that will penetrate armor and slice flesh like cutting a hard-boiled egg. And they cooperate even better than we do, because the brain that is doing the heavy thinking for the squad isn't where you can reach it. It's down one of the holes. Dutch and I stayed lucky for quite a long time, milling around over an area about a mile square, corking up holes with bombs, killing what we found above surface, saving our jets as much as possible for emergencies. The idea was to secure the entire target and allow the reinforcements and the heavy stuff to come down without important opposition. This was not a raid. This was a battle to establish a beachhead, stand on it, hold it, and enable fresh troops and heavies to capture or pacify the entire planet. Only we didn't. Our own section was doing all right. It was in the wrong pew and out of touch with the other section. The platoon leader and sergeant were dead and we never reformed. But we had staked out a claim. Our special weapons squad had set up a strong point, and we were ready to turn over our real estate over to fresh troops as soon as they showed up. Only they didn't. They dropped in where we should have dropped, found unfriendly natives, and had their own troubles. We never saw them. So we stayed where we were, soaking up casualties from time to time, and passing them out ourselves as opportunity offered, while we ran low on ammo and jump juice and even power to keep the suits moving. This seemed to go on for a couple of thousand years. Dutch and I were zipping along close to a wall, headed for our special weapons squad in answer to a yell for help, when the ground suddenly opened in front of Dutch. A big bug popped out, and Dutch went down. I flamed the bug and tossed a grenade, and the hole closed up, then turned to see what had happened to Dutch. He was down, but he didn't look hurt. A platoon sergeant can monitor the physicals of every man in his platoon, sort out the dead from those who merely can't make it unassisted and must be picked up. But you can do the same thing manually from switches right on the belt of the man's suit. Dutch didn't answer when I called him. His body temperature read 99 degrees. His respiration, heartbeat, and brain wave read zero. Which looked bad, but maybe his suit was dead rather than he himself. Or so I told myself, forgetting that the temperature indicator would give no reading if it were the suit rather than the man. Anyhow, I grabbed the can opener wrench from my own belt and started to take him out of his suit while trying to watch all around me. Then I heard an all-hands call in my helmet that I never want to hear again. Sov Kippu, home, home, pick up and home. Any beacon you can hear, 6 minutes. All hands, save yourselves. Pick up your mates. Home on any beacon. Sov ki... I hurried. His head came off as I tried to drag him out of his suit, so I dropped him and got out of there. On a later drop, I would have had sense enough to salvage his ammo, but I was far too sluggish to think. I simply bounced away from there, then tried to rendezvous with the strong point we had been heading for. It was already evacuated, and I felt lost. Lost and deserted. Then I heard recall. Not the recall it should have been, Yankee Doodle, if it had been a boat from the Valley Forge, but Sugarbush, a tune I didn't know. No matter, it was a beacon. I headed for it, using the last of my jump juice lavishly. Got aboard just as they were about to button up, and shortly thereafter was in the Vootrick. In such a state of shock that I couldn't remember my serial number. I've heard it called a strategic victory, but I was there, and I claim we took a terrible licking. 6 weeks later, and feeling about 60 years older, at Fleet Base on Sanctuary, I boarded another ground boat and reported for duty to Ship Sergeant Jalal at the Roger Young. I was wearing, in my pierced left earlobe, a broken skull with one bone. Al Jenkins was with me and was wearing one exactly like it. Kitten never made it out of the tube. The few surviving Wildcats were distributed elsewhere around the fleet. We had lost half our strength, about, in collision with the Valley Forge and the Ypres. That disastrous mess on the ground had run our casualties up over 80%, and the powers that be decided that it was impossible to put the outfit back together with survivors. Close it out, put the records in the archives, and wait until the scars had healed before reactivating Company K, Wildcats, with new faces but old traditions. Besides, there were a lot of empty files to fill in other outfits. Sergeant Jalal welcomed us warmly, told us that we were joining a smart outfit, best in the fleet, in a taut ship, and didn't seem to notice our ear skulls. Later that day, he took us forward to meet the lieutenant, who smiled rather shyly and gave us a fatherly little talk. I noticed that Al Jenkins wasn't wearing his gold skull. Neither was I, because I had already noticed that nobody in Ratchik's Roughnecks wore the skulls. They didn't wear them because, in Ratchik's Roughnecks, it didn't matter in the least how many combat drops you had made, nor which ones. You were either a roughneck, or you weren't. And if you were not, they didn't care who you were. Since we had come to them not as recruits, but as combat veterans, they gave us all possible benefit of doubt, and made us welcome, with no more than that unavoidable trace of formality anybody necessarily shows to a house guest who is not a member of the family. But less than a week later, when we had made one combat drop with them, we were full-fledged roughnecks, members of the family, called by our first names, chewed out on occasion without any feeling on either side that we were less than blood brothers thereby, borrowed from and lent to, included in bull sessions and privileged to express our own silly opinions with complete freedom, and have them slapped down just as freely. We even called non-coms by their first names on any but strictly duty occasions. Sergeant Jalal was always on duty, of course, unless you ran across him dirt side, in which case he was jelly, and went out of his way to behave as if his lordly rank meant nothing between roughnecks. But the lieutenant was always the lieutenant, never Mr. Ratchik, nor even Lieutenant Ratchik, simply the lieutenant, spoken to and of in the third person. There was no god but the lieutenant, and Sergeant Jalal was his prophet. Jelly could say no in his own person, and it might be subject to further argument, at least from junior sergeants. But if he said, the lieutenant wouldn't like it, he was speaking ex cathedra, and the matter was dropped permanently. Nobody ever tried to check up on whether or not the lieutenant would or would not like it. The word had been spoken. The lieutenant was father to us, and loved us, and spoiled us, and was nevertheless rather remote from us aboard ship, and even dirtside, unless we reached dirt via a drop. But in a drop, well, you wouldn't think that an officer could worry about every man of a platoon spread over 100 square miles of terrain. But he can. He can worry himself sick over each one of them. How he could keep track of us all, I can't describe. But in the midst of a ruckus, his voice would sing out over the command circuit. Johnson, check squad 6, Smitty's in trouble. And it was better than even money that the lieutenant had noticed it before Smith's squad leader. Besides that, you knew with utter and absolute certainty that, as long as you were still alive, the lieutenant would not get into the retrieval boat without you. There have been prisoners taken in the Bug War, but none from Ratchik's Roughnecks. Jelly was mother to us, and was close to us, and took care of us and didn't spoil us at all. But he didn't report us to the lieutenant. There was never a court-martial among the roughnecks, and no man was ever flogged. Jelly didn't even pass out extra duty very often. He had other ways of paddling us. He could look you up and down at daily inspection and simply say, in the Navy, you might look good. Why don't you transfer? And get results. It being an article of faith among us that the Navy crew members slept in their uniforms and never washed below their collar lines. But Jelly didn't have to maintain discipline among privates, because he maintained discipline among his non-coms, and expected them to do likewise, My squad leader, when I first joined, was Red Green. After a couple of drops, when I knew how good it was to be a roughneck, I got to feeling gay and a bit too big for my clothes, and talked back to Red. He didn't report me to Jelly. He just took me back to the washroom and gave me a medium set of lumps, and we got to be pretty good friends. In fact, he recommended me for Lance later on. Actually, we didn't know whether the crew members slept in their clothes or not. We kept to our part of the ship, and the Navy men kept to theirs, because they were made to feel uncomfortable if they showed up in our country other than on duty. After all, one has social standards one must maintain, mustn't one? The lieutenant had his stateroom in male officers' country, a Navy part of the ship, but we never went there either, except on duty, and rarely. We did go forward for guard duty, because the Roger Young was a mixed ship. Female captain and pilot officers, some female Navy ratings. Forward of Bulkhead 30 was ladies' country. And two armed MI, day and night, stood guard at the one door cutting it. At battle stations, that door, like all other gas-tight doors, was secured. Nobody missed a drop. Officers were privileged to go forward of Bulkhead 30 on duty, and all officers, including the lieutenant, ate in a mixed mess just beyond it. But they didn't tarry there. They ate and got out. Maybe other corvette transports were run differently. But that was the way the Roger Young was run. Both the lieutenant and Captain de la Dreyer wanted a taut ship and got it. Nevertheless, guard duty was a privilege. It was a rest to stand beside that door, arms folded, feet spread, doping off and thinking about nothing, but always warmly aware that at any moment you might see a feminine creature, even though you were not privileged to speak to her other than on duty. Once I was called all the way into the skipper's office, and she spoke to me. She looked right at me and said, "Take this to the chief engineer, please." My daily shipside job, aside from cleaning, was servicing electronic equipment under the close supervision of Padre Migliaccio, the section leader of the first section, exactly as I used to work under Carl's eye. Drops didn't happen too often, and everybody worked every day. If a man didn't have any other talent, he could always scrub bulkheads. Nothing was ever quite clean enough to suit Sergeant Jalal. We followed the MI rule. Everybody fights, everybody works. Our first cook was Johnson, the second section's sergeant, a big friendly boy from Georgia. The one in the Western Hemisphere, not the other one. And a very talented chef. He wheedled pretty good, too. He liked to eat between meals himself and saw no reason why other people shouldn't. With the padre leading one section and the cook leading the other, we were well taken care of, body and soul. But suppose one of them bought it. Which one would you pick? A nice point we never tried to settle, but could always discuss. The Roger Young kept busy, and we made a number of drops, all different. Every drop has to be different, so that they can never figure out a pattern on you. But no more pitched battles. We operated alone, patrolling, herring, and raiding. The truth was that the Terran Federation was not then able to mount a large battle. The foul-up with Operation Bughouse had cost too many ships, way too many trained men. It was necessary to take time to heal up, train more men. In the meantime, small, fast ships, among them the Roger Young and other corvette transports, tried to be everywhere at once, keeping the enemy off balance, hurting him and running. We suffered casualties and filled our holes when we returned to Sanctuary for more capsules. I still got the shakes every drop. But actual drops didn't happen too often, nor were we ever down long. And between times, there were days and days of shipboard life among the roughnecks. It was the happiest period of my life, although I was never quite consciously aware of it. I did my full share of beefing just as everybody else did, and enjoyed that, too. We weren't really hurt until the lieutenant bought it. I guess that was the worst time in all my life. I was already in bad shape for a personal reason. My mother had been in Buenos Aires when the bugs smeared it. I found out about it one time when we put in at Sanctuary for more capsules and some mail caught up with us. A note from my Aunt Eleonora, one that had not been coded and sent fast, because she had failed to mark for that. The letter itself came. It was about 3 bitter lines. Somehow she seemed to blame me for my mother's death. Whether it was my fault because I was in the armed services and should have therefore prevented the raid, or whether she felt that my mother had made a trip to Buenos Aires because I wasn't home where I should have been, was not quite clear. She managed to imply both in the same sentence. I tore it up and tried to walk away from it. I thought that both my parents were dead, since Father would never send Mother on a trip that long by herself. Aunt Eleonora had not said so, but she wouldn't have mentioned Father in any case. Her devotion was entirely to her sister. I was almost correct. Eventually I learned that Father had planned to go with her, but something had come up and he stayed over to settle it, intending to come along the next day. But Aunt Eleonora did not tell me this. A couple of hours later the lieutenant sent for me and asked me very gently if I would like to take leave at Sanctuary while the ship went out on her next patrol. He pointed out that I had plenty of accumulated R&R and might as well use some of it. I don't know how he knew that I had lost a member of my family, but he obviously did. I said no, thank you, sir. I prefer to wait until the outfit all took R&R together. I'm glad I did it that way, because if I hadn't, I wouldn't have been along when the lieutenant bought it, and that would have been just too much to be borne. It happened very fast and just before retrieval. A man in the 3rd squad was wounded, not badly, but he was down. The assistant section leader moved in to pick up and bought a small piece of it himself. The lieutenant, as usual, was watching everything at once. No doubt he had checked physicals on each of them by remote, but we'll never know. What he did was to make sure that the assistant section leader was still alive, then made pickup on both of them himself, one in each arm of his suit. He threw them the last 20 feet, and they were passed into the retrieval boat. And with everybody else in, the shield gone and no interdiction, was hit and died instantly. I haven't mentioned the names of the private and of the assistant section leader on purpose. The lieutenant was making pickup on all of us with his last breath. Maybe I was the private. It doesn't matter who he was. What did matter was that our family had had its head chopped off. The head of the family from which we took our name. The father who made us what we were. After the lieutenant had to leave us, Captain de la Dreyer invited Sergeant Jalal to eat forward, with the other heads of departments. But he begged to be excused. Have you ever seen a widow with stern character keep her family together? By behaving as if the head of the family had simply stepped out and would return at any moment? That's what Jelly did. He was just a touch more strict with us than ever, and if he ever had to say, the lieutenant wouldn't like that, it was almost more than a man could take. Jelly didn't say it very often. He left our combat team organization almost unchanged. Instead of shifting everybody around, he moved the assistant section leader of the 2nd section over into the nominal platoon sergeant spot, leaving his section leaders where they were needed, with their sections. And he moved me from Lance to assistant squad leader, into acting corporal as a largely ornamental assistant section leader. Then he himself behaved as if the lieutenant were merely out of sight, and that he was just passing on the lieutenant's orders, as usual. It saved us. 11. I have nothing to offer but blood, toil, tears, and sweat. W. Churchill, 20th Century Soldier Statesman. As we came back into the ship after the raid on the skinnies, the raid in which Dizzy Flores bought it, Sergeant Jalal's first drop as platoon leader. A ship's gunner, who was tending the boat lock, spoke to me. "How'd it go?" "Routine," I answered briefly. I suppose his remark was friendly, but I was feeling very mixed up and in no mood to talk. Sad over Dizzy, glad that we had made pickup anyhow, mad that the pickup had been useless, and all of it tangled up with that washed out but happy feeling of being back in the ship again, able to muster arms and legs and note that they are all present. Besides, how can you talk about a drop to a man who has never made one? "So," he answered, "you guys have got it soft. Loaf 30 days, work 30 minutes. Me, I stand a watch in 3 and turn 2. "Yeah, I guess so," I agreed and turned away. "Some of us are born lucky." "Soldier, you ain't peddling vacuum," he said to my back. And yet there was much truth in what the Navy gunner had said. We cap troopers are like aviators of the early mechanized war. A long and busy military career could contain only a few hours of actual combat facing the enemy, the rest being train, get ready, go out, then come back, clean up the mess, get ready for another one, and practice, practice, practice in between. We didn't make another drop for almost 3 weeks, and that on a different planet around another star. A bug colony. Even with Cherenkov Drive, stars are far apart. In the meantime, I got my corporal stripes, nominated by Jelly and confirmed by Captain Deladryer, in the absence of a commissioned officer of our own. Theoretically, the rank would not be permanent until approved against vacancy by the Fleet MI, Repel Depple. But that meant nothing, as the casualty rate was such that there were always more vacancies in the TO than there were warm bodies to fill them. I was a corporal when Jelly said I was a corporal. The rest was red tape. But the gunner was not quite correct about loafing. There were 53 suits of powered armor to check, service and repair between each drop, not to mention weapons and special equipment. Sometimes Miliaccio would down-check a suit. Jelly would confirm it, and the ship's weapons engineer, Lieutenant Farley, would decide that he couldn't cure it short of base facilities, whereupon a new suit would have to be broken out of stores and brought from cold to hot, an exacting process requiring 26 man-hours, not counting the time of the man to whom it was being fitted. We kept busy. But we had fun, too. There were always several competitions going on, from AC Ducey to Honor Squad, and we had the best jazz band in several cubic light years. Well, the only one, maybe. With Sergeant Johnson on the trumpet, leading them mellow and sweet for hymns, or tearing the steel right off the bulkheads, as the occasion required. After that masterful, or should it be mistressful, retrieval rendezvous without a program ballistic, the platoon's metalsmith, PFC Archie Campbell, made a model of the Roger Young for the skipper, and we all signed it, and Archie engraved our signatures on the base plate. To Hot Pilot Yvette Deladryer, with thanks from Ratchix Roughnecks. And we invited her aft to eat with us, and the roughneck downbeat combo played during dinner, and then the junior private presented it to her. She got tears and kissed him, and kissed Jelly as well, and he blushed purple. After I got my chevrons, I simply had to get things straight with Ace, because Jelly kept me on as assistant section leader. This is not good. A man ought to fill each spot on his way up. I should have had to turn as squad leader instead of being bumped from Lance to assistant squad leader, to corporal and assistant section leader. Jelly knew this, of course, but I know perfectly well that he was trying to keep the outfit as much as possible the way it had been when the lieutenant was alive, which meant that he left his squad leaders and section leaders unchanged. But it left me with a ticklish problem. All 3 of the corporals under me as squad leaders were actually senior to me. But if Sergeant Johnson bought it on the next drop, it would not only lose us a mighty fine cook, it would leave me leading the section. There mustn't be any shadow of doubt when you give an order, not in combat. I had to clear up any possible shadow before we dropped again. Ace was the problem. He was not only senior of the three, he was a career corporal as well, and older than I was. If Ace accepted me, I wouldn't have any trouble with the other two squads. I hadn't really had any trouble with him aboard. After we made pickup on Flores together, he had been civil enough. On the other hand, we hadn't had anything to have trouble over. Our shipside jobs didn't put us together, except at daily muster and guard mount, which is all cut and dried. But you can feel it. He was not treating me as somebody he took orders from. So I looked him up during off hours. He was lying in his bunk reading a book, Space Rangers Against the Galaxy. A pretty good yarn, except that I doubt if a military outfit ever had so many adventures and so few goof-offs. The ship had a good library. Ace, got to see you. He glanced up. So? I just left the ship. I'm off duty. I've got to see you now. Put your book down. What's so aching urgent? I've got to finish this chapter. Oh, come off it, Ace. If you can't wait, I'll tell you how it comes out. You do, and I'll clobber you. He put the book down, sat up, and listened. I said, Ace, about this matter of section organization. You're senior to me. You ought to be assistant section leader. Oh, so it's that again. Yep. I think you and I ought to go see Johnson and get him to fix it up with Jelly. You do, eh? Yes, I do. That's how it's got to be. So, look, Shorty, let me put you straight. I got nothing against you at all. Matter of fact, you were on the bounce that day we had to pick up Dizzy. I'll hand you that. But if you want a squad, you go dig up one of your own. Don't go eyeing mine. Why, my boys wouldn't even peel potatoes for you. That's your final word? That's my first, last, and only word. I sighed. I thought it would be, but I had to make sure. Well, that settles that. But I got one thing on my mind. I happen to notice that the washroom needs cleaning, and I think maybe you and I ought to attend to it. So put your book aside, as Jelly says. Non-coms are always on duty. He didn't stir at once. He said quietly, You really think it's necessary, Shorty? As I said, I got nothing against you. Looks like. Think you can do it? I can sure try. Okay, let's take care of it. We went aft to the washroom, chased out a private who was about to take a shower he didn't really need, and locked the door. Ace said, You got any restrictions in mind, Shorty? Well, I hadn't planned to kill you. Check, and no broken bones. Nothing that would keep either one of us from the next drop. Except maybe an accident, of course. That suit you? Suits, I agreed. I think maybe I'll take my shirt off. Wouldn't want to get blood on your shirt. He relaxed. I started to peel it off, and he let go a kick for my kneecap. No wind-up, flat-footed and not tense. Only my kneecap wasn't there. I had learned. A real fight ordinarily can last only a second or two, because that is all the time it takes to kill a man, or knock him out, or disable him to the point where he can't fight. But we had agreed to avoid inflicting permanent damage. This changes things. We were both young, in top condition, highly trained, and used to absorbing punishment. Ace was bigger. I was maybe a touch faster. Under such conditions, the miserable business simply has to go on until one or the other is too beaten down to continue, unless a fluke settles it sooner. But neither one of us was allowing any flukes. We were professionals and wary. So it did go on for a long, tedious, painful time. Details would be trivial and pointless. Besides, I had no time to take notes. A long time later, I was lying on my back and Ace was flipping water on my face. He looked at me, then hauled me to my feet, shoved me against a bulkhead, steadied me.
Hit me.
Huh? I was dazed and seeing double.
Johnny, hit me.
His face was floating in the air in front of me. I zeroed in on it and slugged it with all the force in my body. Hard enough to smash any mosquito in poor health. His eyes closed and he slumped to the deck, and I had to grab at the stanchion to keep from following him. He got up slowly.
Okay, Johnny, he said, shaking his head.
I've had my lesson. You won't have any more lip out of me, nor out of anybody in the section, okay? I nodded, but my head hurt.
Shake?
He asked. We shook on it, and that hurt too. Almost anybody else knew more about how the war was going on than we did, even though we were in it. This was the period, of course, after the bugs had located our home planet, through the skinnies, and had raided it, destroying Buenos Aires and turning contact troubles into all-out war. But before we had built up our forces, and before the skinnies had changed sides and become our co-belligerents and de facto allies. Partly effective interdiction for Terra had been set up from Luna. We didn't know it. But speaking broadly, the Terran Federation was losing the war. We didn't know that either. Nor did we know that strenuous efforts were being made to subvert the alliance against us and bring the skinnies over to our side. The nearest we came to being told about that was when we got instructions, before the raid in which Flores was killed, to go easy on the skinnies, destroy as much property as possible, but to kill inhabitants only when unavoidable. What a man doesn't know, he can't spill if he is captured. Neither drugs, nor torture, nor brainwash, nor endless lack of sleep can squeeze out a secret he does not possess. So we were told only what we had to know for tactical purposes. In the past, armies have been known to fold up and quit because the men didn't know what they were fighting for, or why, and therefore lacked the will to fight. But the MI doesn't have that weakness. Each one of us is a volunteer to begin with. Each, for some reason or other, some good, some bad. But now we fought because we were MI. We were professionals, with esprit de corps. We were Ratchix Roughnecks, the best, unprintable, outfit in the whole expurgated MI. We climbed into our capsules because Jelly told us it was time to do so, and we fought when we got down there because that is what Ratchix Roughnecks do. We certainly didn't know that we were losing. Those bugs lay eggs. They not only lay them, they hold them in reserve, hatch them as needed. If we killed a warrior, or 1,000 or 10,000, his or their replacements were hatched and on duty almost before we could get back to base. You can imagine, if you like, some bug's supervisor of population flashing a phone to somewhere down inside and saying, "Joe, warm up 10,000 warriors and have them ready by Wednesday. And tell engineering to activate reserve incubators N, O, P, Q, and R. The demand is picking up." I don't say they did exactly that, but those were the results. But don't make the mistake of thinking that they acted purely from instinct, like termites or ants. Their actions were as intelligent as ours. Stupid races don't build spaceships. And we're much better coordinated. It takes a minimum of a year to train a private to fight and to mesh his fighting in with his mates. A bug warrior is hatched, able to do this. Every time we killed 1,000 bugs at a cost of 1 MI, it was a net victory for the bugs. We were learning, expensively, just how efficient a total communism can be when used by a people actually adapted to it by evolution. The bug commissars didn't care any more about expending soldiers than we cared about expending ammo. Perhaps we could have figured this out about the bugs by noting the grief the Chinese hegemony gave the Russo-Anglo-American alliance. However, the trouble with lessons from history is that we usually read them best after falling flat on our chins. But we were learning. Technical instructions and tactical doctrine orders resulting from every brush with them spread through the fleet. We learned to tell the workers from the warriors. If you had time, you could tell them from the shape of the carapace. But the quick rule of thumb was, if he comes at you, he's a warrior. If he runs, you can turn your back on him. We learned not to waste ammo even on warriors except in self-protection. Instead, we went after their lairs. Find a hole, drop down it first a gas bomb, which explodes gently a few seconds later, releasing an oily liquid which evaporates as a nerve gas tailored to the bugs. It is harmless to us, and which is heavier than air and keeps on going down. Then you use a second grenade of HE to seal the hole. We still didn't know whether we were getting deep enough to kill the queens, but we did know that the bugs didn't like these tactics. Our intelligence through the skinnies and on back into the bugs themselves was definite on this point. Besides, we cleaned their colony off Sheol completely this way. Maybe they managed to evacuate the queens and the brains, but at least we were learning to hurt them. But so far as the roughnecks were concerned, these gas bombings were simply another drill to be done according to orders, by the numbers, and on the bounce. Eventually, we had to go back to Sanctuary for more capsules. Capsules are expendable. Well, so are we. And when they are gone, you must return to base, even if the Cherenkov generators could still take you twice around the galaxy. Shortly before this, a dispatch came through breveting Jelly to Lieutenant, Vice Ratchik. Jelly tried to keep it quiet, but Captain Deladryer published it and then required him to eat forward with the other officers. He still spent all the rest of his time aft. But we had taken several drops by then with him as platoon leader, and the outfit had gotten used to getting along without the lieutenant. It still hurt, but it was routine now. After Jalal was commissioned, the word was slowly passed around among us and chewed over that it was time for us to name ourselves for our boss, as with other outfits. Johnson was senior and took the word to Jelly. He picked me to go along with him as moral support.
"Yeah," growled Jelly.
Lieutenant, we've been thinking."
"With what?"
"Well, the boys have sort of been talking it over, and they think, well, they say the outfit ought to call itself Jelly's Jaguars."
"They do, eh? How many of them favor that name?"
"It's unanimous," Johnson said simply.
"So, 52 ayes and one no. The noes have it."
Nobody ever brought up the subject again. Shortly after that, we orbited at Sanctuary. I was glad to be there, as the ship's internal pseudo-gravity field had been off for most of the 2 days before that, while the chief engineer tinkered with it, leaving us in free fall, which I hate. I'll never be a real spaceman. Dirt underfoot felt good. The entire platoon went on 10 days rest and recreation and transferred to accommodation barracks at the base. I have never learned the coordinates of Sanctuary, nor the name or catalog number of the starred orbits, because what you don't know, you can't spill. The location is ultra top secret, known only by ship's captains, piloting officers and such, and, I understand, with each of them under orders and hypnotic compulsion to suicide, if necessary to avoid capture. So I don't want to know. With the possibility that Luna Base might be taken and Terra herself occupied, the Federation kept as much of its beef as possible at Sanctuary, so that a disaster back home would not necessarily mean capitulation. But I can tell you what sort of planet it is. Like Earth, but retarded. Literally, retarded. Like a kid who takes 10 years to learn to wave bye-bye and never does manage to master patty cake. It is a planet as near like Earth as two planets can be. Same age, according to the planetologists, and its star is the same as the Sun and the same type, so say the astrophysicists. It has plenty of flora and fauna, same atmosphere as Earth, near enough, and much the same weather. It even has a good-sized moon and Earth's exceptional tides. With all these advantages, it barely got away from the starting gate. You see, it's short on mutations. It does not enjoy Earth's high level of natural radiation. Its typical and most highly developed plant life is a very primitive giant fern. Its top animal life is a proto-insect, which hasn't even developed colonies. I am not speaking of transplanted Terran flora and fauna. Our stuff moves in and brushes the native stuff aside. With its evolutionary progress held down almost to zero by lack of radiation, and a consequent most unhealthily low mutation rate, native life forms on Sanctuary just haven't had a decent chance to evolve and aren't fit to compete. Their gene patterns remain fixed for a relatively long time. They aren't adaptable, like being forced to play the same bridge hand over and over again, for eons with no hope of getting a better one. As long as they just competed with each other, this didn't matter too much. Morons among morons, so to speak. But when types that had evolved on a planet enjoying high radiation and fierce competition were introduced, the native stuff was outclassed. Now, all the above is perfectly obvious from high school biology, but the high forehead from the research station there, who was telling me about this, brought up a point I never would have thought of. What about the human beings who have colonized Sanctuary? Not transients like me, but colonists who live there, many of whom were born there, and whose descendants will live there, even unto the upteenth generation. What about those descendants? It doesn't do a person any harm not to be radiated. In fact, it's a bit safer. Leukemia and some types of cancer are almost unknown here. Besides that, the economic situation is at present all in their favor. When they plant a field of Terran wheat, they don't even have to clear out the weeds. Terran wheat displaces anything native. But the descendants of those colonists won't evolve. Not much, anyhow. This chap told me that they could improve a little through mutation from other causes, from new blood added by immigration, and from natural selection among the gene patterns they already own. But that is all very minor compared to the evolutionary rate on Terra, and on any usual planet. So what happens? Do they stay frozen at their present level while the rest of the human race moves on past them, until they are living fossils? As out of place as a pithecanthropus in a spaceship? Or will they worry about the fate of their descendants and dose themselves regularly with X-rays, or maybe set off lots of dirty-type nuclear explosions each year to build up a fallout reservoir in the atmosphere? Accepting, of course, the immediate dangers of radiation to themselves in order to provide a proper genetic heritage of mutation for the benefit of their descendants. This bloke predicted that they would not do anything. He claims that the human race is too individualistic, too self-centered to worry that much about future generations. He says that the genetic impoverishment of distant generations through lack of radiation is something most people are simply incapable of worrying about. And of course, it is a far distant threat. Evolution works so slowly, even on Terra, that the development of a new species is a matter of many, many thousands of years. I don't know. Shucks, I don't know what I myself will do more than half the time. How can I predict what a colony of strangers will do? But I'm sure of this. Sanctuary is going to be fully settled either by us or by the bugs, or by somebody. It is a potential utopia, and with desirable real estate so scarce in this end of the galaxy, it will not be left in the possession of primitive life forms that failed to make the grade. Already it is a delightful place, better in many ways for a few days R&R than most of Terra. In the second place, while it has an awful lot of civilians, more than a million, as civilians go, they aren't bad. They know there is a war on. Fully half of them are employed either at the base or in the war industry. The rest raise food and sell it to the fleet. You might say they have a vested interest in war, but, whatever their reasons, they respect the uniform and don't resent the wearers thereof. Quite the contrary. If an MI walks into a shop there, the proprietor calls him sir,
and really seems to mean it, even while he's trying to sell something worthless at too high a price. But in the first place, half of those civilians are female. You have to have been out on a long patrol to appreciate this properly. You need to have looked forward to your day of guard duty for the privilege of standing 2 hours out of each six with your spine against Bulkhead 30 and your ears cocked for just the sound of a female voice. I suppose it's actually easier in the all-stag ships, but I'll take the Roger Young. It's good to know that the ultimate reason you are fighting actually exists, and that they are not just a figment of the imagination. Besides the civilian wonderful 50%, about 40% of the federal service people on Sanctuary are female. Add it all up, and you've got the most beautiful scenery in the explored universe. Besides these unsurpassed natural advantages, a great deal has been done artificially to keep R&R from being wasted. Most of the civilians seem to hold two jobs. They've got circles under their eyes from staying up all night to make a serviceman's leave pleasant. Churchill Road from the base to the city is lined both sides with enterprises intended to separate painlessly a man from money he really hasn't any use for anyhow, to the pleasant accompaniment of refreshment, entertainment, and music. If you are able to get past these traps, through having already been bled of all valuta, there are still other places in the city almost as satisfactory. I mean, there are girls there, too, which are provided free by a grateful populace, much like the social center in Vancouver these are, but even more welcome. Sanctuary, and especially Espiritu Santo, the city, struck me as such an ideal place that I toyed with the notion of asking for my discharge there when my term was up. After all, I didn't really care whether my descendants, if any, 25,000 years hence had long green tendrils like everybody else, or just the equipment I had been forced to get by with. That professor type from the research station couldn't frighten me with that no radiation scare talk. It seemed to me, from what I could see around me, that the human race had reached its ultimate peak anyhow. No doubt a gentleman warthog feels the same way about a lady warthog, but if so, both of us are very sincere. There are other opportunities for recreation there, too. I remember, with particular pleasure, one evening when a table of roughnecks got into a friendly discussion with a group of Navy men, not from the Roger Young, seated at the next table. The debate was spirited, a bit noisy, and some base police came in and broke it up with stun guns just as we were warming up to our rebuttal. Nothing came of it, except that we had to pay for the furniture. The base commandant takes the position that a man on R&R should be allowed a little freedom as long as he doesn't pick one of the 31 crash landings. The accommodation barracks are all right, too. Not fancy, but comfortable. And the chow line works 25 hours a day, with civilians doing all the work. No reveille, no taps. You're actually on leave, and you don't have to go to the barracks at all. I did, however, as it seemed downright preposterous to spend money on hotels when there was a clean, soft sack free, and so much better ways to spend accumulated pay. That extra hour in each day was nice, too, as it meant 9 hours solid and the day still untouched. I caught up some sack time clear back to Operation Bughouse. It might as well have been a hotel. Ace and I had a room all to ourselves in visiting non-com quarters. One morning, when the R&R was regrettably drawing to a close, I was just turning over about local noon when Ace shook my bed. "On the bounce, soldier. The bugs are attacking." I told him what to do with the bugs. "Let's hit the dirt," he persisted. "No De Niro." I'd had a date the night before with a chemist, female, of course, and charmingly so, from the research station. She had known Carl on Pluto, and Carl had written to me to look her up if I ever got to Sanctuary. She was a slender redhead, with expensive tastes.
Apparently Carl had intimated to her that I had more money than was good for me, for she decided that the night before was just the time for her to get acquainted with the local champagne. I didn't let Carl down by admitting that all I had was a trooper's honorarium. I bought it for her while I drank what they said was, but wasn't, fresh pineapple squash. The result was that I had to walk home afterwards. The cabs aren't free. Still, it had been worth it. After all, what is money? I'm speaking of bug money, of course. "No ache," Ace answered. "I can juice you. I got lucky last night. Ran into a Navy file who didn't know percentages." So, I got up and shaved and showered, and we hit the chow line for half a dozen shell eggs and sundries, such as potatoes and ham and hotcakes and so forth. And then we hit the dirt to get something to eat. The walk up Churchill Road was hot, and Ace decided to stop in a cantina. I went along to see if their pineapple squash was real. It wasn't, but it was cold. You can't have everything. We talked about this and that, and Ace ordered another round. I tried their strawberry squash. Same deal. Ace stared into his glass, then said, "Ever thought about greasing for officer?" I said, "Huh? Are you crazy?" "Nope. Look, Johnny, this war may run on quite a piece. No matter what propaganda they put out for the folks at home, you and I know that the bugs aren't ready to quit. So why don't you plan ahead? As the man says, if you've got to play in the band, it's better to wave the stick than to carry the big drum." I was startled by the turn the talk had taken, especially from Ace. "Well, how about you? Are you planning to buck for a commission?" "Me?" he answered. "Check your circuits, son. You're getting wrong answers. I've got no education, and I'm 10 years older than you are. But you've got enough education to hit the selection exams for OCS, and you've got the IQ they like. I guarantee that if you go career, you'll make sergeant before I do, and get picked for OCS the day after." "Now I know you're crazy." "Listen to your pop. I hate to tell you this, but you are just stupid and eager and sincere enough to make the kind of officer that men love to follow into some silly predicament. But me? Well, I'm a natural non-com, with a proper pessimistic attitude to offset the enthusiasm of the likes of you. Someday I'll make sergeant, and presently I'll have my 20 years in, and retire and get one of those reserve jobs. Cop, maybe. And marry a nice fat wife with the same low tastes I have. And I'll follow the sports and fish and go pleasantly to pieces." Ace stopped to wet his whistle. "But you," he went on, "you'll stay in and probably make high rank and die gloriously, and I'll read about it and say proudly, 'I knew him when. Why, I used to lend him money. We were corporals together.'" "Well?" "I've never thought about it," I said slowly. "I just meant to serve my term." He grinned sourly. "Do you see any term enrollees being paid off today? You expect to make it on 2 years?" He had a point. As long as the war continued, a term didn't end, at least not for cap troopers. It was mostly a difference in attitude, at least for the present. Those of us on term could at least feel like short-timers. We could talk about it. When this flea-bitten war is over. A career man doesn't say that. He wasn't going anywhere, short of retirement or buying it. On the other hand, neither were we. But if you went career and then didn't finish 20, well, they could be pretty sticky about your franchise, even though they wouldn't keep a man who didn't want to stay. "Maybe not a 2-year term," I admitted. "But the war won't last forever."
"It won't."
"How can it?"
"Blessed if I know. They don't tell me these things.
But I know that's not what is troubling you, Johnny. You got a girl waiting?"
"No."
Well, I had, I answered slowly. But she, dear Johned me.